Hi there. Welcome back to the podcast. It is my absolute privilege to welcome back to the show Dr. Michael Gradisar. Michael, welcome back.
G'day, mate. How are you?
I am very good, and I'm excited now because we spoke about the basics of sleep and light in the last episode, and right at the end, we gave a little bit of a teaser that this notion of screens and screen time that is often promoted in the media as having a detrimental impact on sleep and circadian rhythm is maybe not as true as some people believe. So today's episode is going to be all about screens and sleep. I would say, said simply, your work has completely reorganized the mental furniture on the deck of my understanding of screens and how they impact sleep. And in truth, in my book some years ago, I was more than declarative, let's say, dictatorial, you could say, about how the light from screens was the main problem when it comes to sleep. And I also spoke about that in public. But your work really made me change my mind. And it has been such a pleasure to go back out into the public and admit when you're wrong, or at least require a heavy, heavy update. And maybe we know some scientists, or certainly folks in the public, that see admitting that you're wrong as a weakness, meaning that, okay, you got it wrong. But with all respect and compassion to them, I'm not a politician. I'm not there to hold my line. I'm a scientist. As a scientist, we're interested in the truth. And if you've aligned with one truth, but the latest data violates that, I think the more concerning weakness would be to not abandon your previous stance and revise your current belief set. And I'm getting ahead of my skis here, but so let's first set the stage though. And it's something that we mentioned right at the end of the last episode. Where were things regarding quote unquote screens and sleep 10 or 12 years ago?
Yeah, about that time was when I will have to admit we published a review looking at the links between screens and sleep. And the research data at that point was showing that there is a link. It wasn't necessarily talking about the strength of that link. It wasn't even talking necessarily about the direction of that link, I would have to say. But we basically published that, I think it was in 2010. And it's been the most cited, the most popular paper that I've ever written. It's had over 1,000 citations. And I guess that started to give this impression, at least to sleep scientists, that there was something problematic about screens and technology use before sleep. And within that actual paper, we wanted to be able to sort of say, why? Why is this happening? Why is there this link? And we proposed some mechanisms. And one of those mechanisms that we proposed was the potential for the bright screens just before bed to have an impact on people's sleep. But at that time in 2010, there actually weren't any studies directly testing that.
There has been a chapter published in 2011 on the topic of screens and lights, and I know you're very familiar there with that too. Tell me a little bit about the TLDR, as people describe it, on the core take-home messages that you've described between technology use or screen times and not just sleep, but especially the quality of your sleep.
Yeah, it was interesting for us because we published that chapter in 2013. So this was really when there was a lot of fascination about this topic, and we were starting to see a lot more studies that were coming out. And I will say, unfortunately, the studies were a little bit more sort of survey studies. So basically questionnaires where people were asked, what's your sleep like? What's your sleep quality like? How much do you sleep? And basically their pre-bedtime activities when it came to using technology. So it was really suggesting that there is a link, but it wasn't really sort of telling us much more than that. And so once again, we were noticing that there were a lot more researchers that were also proposing as an interpretation that maybe this problematic association between pre-bedtime technology use and sleep is due to the screens. And not just the fact that these screens are bright and you should be in darkness leading up to bedtime, but also that the current technology was showing that these screens were emitting a higher concentration of blue light that we've already spoken about that's quite alerting and has the potential to delay the circadian rhythm. But once again, we're noticing that there were actually no scientific studies directly testing if this was true or not.
Because those survey studies, they're simply correlational. They don't prove causality.
Exactly. And that's what we really needed. We needed some people to really sort of get into a sleep laboratory and do an experiment. So by that, I mean manipulate what's called your independent variable. Say, for example, have a bright screen on one night, have a dim screen on another night, maybe even manipulate the colors coming from that screen and measure sleep. And do you see that if you change the brightness of the screen, the colors coming from the screen, does that have an impact on sleep?
Which then reminds me, tell me, and this will dovetail into that statement, a little bit about a study we are both familiar with from the incredible Dr. Christian Kajokan on the topic of screen light and sleep. And maybe tell us a little bit about what they found in that study, but also maybe remind me about some of the limitations. And now, by the way, my studies, for example, oh my goodness, the limitation sections would probably be three times as long as the main studies, meaning that every piece of science has some kind of limitations. This is not deriding any aspect of Christian's fantastic work, but I think it's always good to describe what they find and how we can manage our contextual thinking around that in the mindset of any limitations that the audience should understand.
Yeah, and I totally agree. Like, this study was fantastic, and these researchers are also fantastic. And you're dead right. When it comes to studies, it's not just the limitations, but the strengths. And this study had a lot of strengths. So to sort of really set the scene, what happened is that they took a group of young adults and they exposed them just before bed to either a bright screen that was predominantly white background. I believe they were sort of watching scenes of people in the snow and so forth. So on one particular night, they were watching these scenes on a bright screen for 5 hours before bed. And on another night, the screen was dim. And what they did is they took these whole bunch of different host of measures that were really assessing people's alertness leading up to bedtime whilst they were looking at either a bright screen or a dim screen. So essentially, they were taking people's subjective ratings of how sleepy they were feeling. They were looking at basically aspects of their EEG. I think they were even looking at their eye blinks. And one really important thing that they did is that they measured people's melatonin levels on the rise to when they would actually fall asleep. And as you would imagine, and as we've sort of spoken about, is that melatonin naturally should rise in the lead up to bedtime. And this is precisely what it showed when people were in front of a dim screen for 5 hours. But then when they were exposed to a bright screen, they actually had a suppression of that melatonin. So melatonin did still rise, but not at the same levels as when they were looking at a dim screen. So that was really fascinating work. And all of these different measures were really pointing to the fact that people were more alert if they looked at a bright screen.
Which seems to confirm this mentality, this modus operandi out there that the screens are having a real impact on your circadian rhythm and melatonin.
Absolutely. But, and here's the but, the limitation when it came to this particular study, and I would love to ask Christian about this, but they didn't actually measure how long it took people to fall asleep after that study. And they usually do. So I was a little bit surprised, but that was not going to be their first and last study. But it really was an inspiration for us in trying to really directly test whether a bright screen would affect people's sleep and make it difficult for them to fall asleep.
And what would you say since those early days, maybe 10 years ago now, what has then been the experimental evidence regarding impacts on sleep? Because that fantastic paper from Christian was saying, okay, as we're awake and we're leading up to the moment of falling asleep, certainly the light is having a biological influence. There is clearly something going on in terms of the hormones, including melatonin circulating, your brainwave activity, also aspects of your eye movement and how you are subjectively feeling. But what have people found when they say, okay, then we're not going to stop there, we're going to keep going, and we're going to measure sleep? As astronomical an impact as we would therefore imagine?
This is where I think it's really important, and I've definitely found this when it comes to doing research and technology and sleep, that sometimes people can think it's common sense. We don't need science to actually know if this is true or not. And that's what we sort of do with science. We try to sort of find out if aspects of our world are true, likely or not. And so we were really fascinated about that study and the fact that we were just seeing all of these hints that technology use could affect sleep. It could be the bright screen and it could be the sort of enriched blue light that comes from these screens. We set about doing a test of this in our own sleep laboratory. So we invited teenagers in this instance because teenagers essentially love to use technology. And I do actually love working with them. They're a great bunch of people. On one night, we got them to basically use an iPad for 1 hour before bed, and it was set to full brightness. Similar to Christian's study, we ensured that the background was going to be predominantly white. Now, because that still looks like it's a white screen, and as we've mentioned in a previous podcast, you sort of project white light towards a prism or a rain droplet, and you'll get all the different colors of the rainbow. So essentially, they're getting not only bright light, but they're also getting a reasonable dose of blue-enriched light. So on a subsequent night, we also got them to have a bright screen. However, at that point in time, these were Apple iPads, and we were putting on there an app called F.Lux. And what this did was it essentially reduced the amount of blue light coming from these iPads. And as a result, what you perceive as the human being looking at this tablet is that you have this sort of warm glow coming from the screen. It's not necessarily this bright, pure white light that you're getting. It's more of a sort of a orangey white light, so to speak. And then on a third night, we got the teenagers to come in and we had a completely dim screen, no F.Lux, but just completely dim. And likewise, we were inspired by what Christian had done, and so we tried to essentially use the same measures while people were using this iPad for 1 hour. And I must say that we wanted to use 1 hour because there was always this classic thing going around saying you should not use technology in the hour before bed, so hence why we just stuck to this 1 hour. Then we measured their sleep with polysomnography, so essentially EEG is the best way, the most accurate way to determine how long people take to fall asleep. And we were somewhat surprised by the results because compared to, say, a dim screen, it took approximately 3.5 minutes longer to fall asleep after using a bright screen. So we were really going, oh my God, are we going to actually publish
this? That's margin of error kind of stuff. You know, that's not a 30-minute delay, which you were talking about.
Yeah, it was really, really small. And we were concerned that, you know, this is not going to actually get out into the public.
Because of bias from reviewers, perhaps even like me, who would think, no, this must have an effect. And you don't almost, quote unquote, allow the study to come out. Wow.
Yeah, which is a bias that's absolutely fascinating me now, as we sort of spoke about in the previous episode, that this is now becoming a bit of a myth because people, they already have their biases about this particular topic. And when you're faced with this particular evidence, do you evolve? And your story has fascinated me as well. What's been fascinating is that, yes, we got that published. And since then, to sort of summarize as much as possible, there's been about 10 studies that have looked at this particular topic in different populations, different aspects of the world, different measures of sleep, different devices, different ways to reduce that blue light, whether it's with an app or just looking at a printed book or using blue blocking glasses. And from my perspective, they're all showing a very similar result, that this whole concept that the blue enriched light coming from a screen does not necessarily lead to difficulty falling asleep.
By the way, for folks listening, f.lux is a program. It's available for Macs and PCs. It's also available for your mobile devices. It's available on iOS for Apple products and also Android if you're down in that realm too, or up in that realm, depending on what your beliefs of the echelon. By the way, the Apple has also come out on computers now and phones. This is very similar to something called Night Shift, which I should actually give a tip of the hat to a wonderful scientist, Dr. Stephanie Greer. She did actually her PhD with me here at UC Berkeley. And then, wisely, she didn't follow my path of becoming an academic. She went out into industry and she went out to work for Apple in their sleep division and was a critical player in developing that component of the software. So thank you, Stephanie, for your contributions there. A sponsor of today's show is Inside Tracker, which is a service that comes out to your home and they will analyze your blood and your DNA to know precisely what is going on inside of you. Hence the name, Inside Tracker. They look at your blood, your metabolic signals, your hormonal health metrics, and then they give you a personalized, actionable set of lifestyle changes in response to that readout. And the goal there is to improve your health. I was looking and informed they have some new cardiovascular and new hormonal biomarkers that I'm particularly interested in. One that I'm focused on is something called ApoB, which is an absolutely critical heart health measure. And I get it done now with them somewhere between 4 to 6 times a year. Why? Well, my family, unfortunately, has a strong history of cardiovascular disease. So I am checking that pretty ruthlessly. And by the way, I do buy the product myself out of pocket. I don't want to fall prey to any of those trappings and undue incentives. Although with full admission, I still use my own discount code that you can use to get some money off. And that code for you is insidetracker.com/Matt Walker. So just go over to insidetracker.com/Matt Walker. And again, if you want to get that discount, it is insidetracker.com/Matt Walker. Thanks very much. Above and beyond that, what I find interesting and something I featured very heavily in my book, and when I was then out in the public, I would speak about this study and another one that subsequently came out. There was a fascinating and again, a great study with limitations that came out of Harvard, where I was a first professor at Harvard Medical School, great sleep division, and they did a fantastic study. I wasn't part of it. I'm jealous that I wasn't. And it was published in a very prestigious journal called Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, or the acronym PNAS, as my friend Andrew Huberman says, have all the jokes you want about that. And then there was another study, a Norwegian study, of very like kind. And really the bottom line there was that 1 hour of iPad reading does seem to change how easy or hard it is to fall asleep. It changes the different stages of your sleep. You don't feel great the next day. And then when you stop using that iPad relative to maybe just reading a standard book, there's a blast radius and it's almost like a drug that it has a washout period that it doesn't just go away when you stop it. It takes a few days to finally get back to normality of sleep. But tell me a little bit about how your research and the work of many others now compares to that study and the study from Norway. And again, we're not criticizing anyone. The researchers are brilliant. The papers were fantastic. I love the papers. Everything has limitations. Tell us a little bit about maybe what those studies found and then how do they contrast with the stuff that you've been discovering?
Yeah, and I totally agree. The Harvard study really is a standout because unlike other studies, including ours, where we sort of have these single nights where we test these different sorts of screens. What Harvard did is that they had people come in for 5 consecutive nights, and that's huge to be able to do that. So on 1 week, they would have an e-reader, like you said, and on another week, they would have a printed book. So really, if you have a printed book, you're not necessarily getting light from the screen because there is no screen, and therefore you're not getting this blue and rich light. when you look at the Harvard study, there's some fascinating aspects to it. But if I just hone in on one aspect, and it is this concept of difficulty falling asleep, because that's what we see, you know, that's really propagated through social media, is that that study statistically, through statistical analyses, found that it took longer to fall asleep after the e-reader compared to the printed book. And that's probably something that has been mentioned a number of times. But if you dig a little bit deeper, the amount of time that it took to fall asleep that was longer from reading the e-reader was 9.9 minutes. I think the actual study says it took almost 10 minutes. Now, really, when you look at the Norwegian study that did a similar thing, but not necessarily in a laboratory, but in the home of participants, they actually found that it took 8.1 minutes longer to fall asleep after the printed book. So they really found the reverse of what the Harvard study. There's been a number of other studies, both with strengths and limitations, but the fact is the biggest strength here is that we have a number of independent studies looking at the same thing. That's where the real strength is, and that's where science comes together and gives us a better understanding of whether something is true or not in our world. And probably the most recent one I remember reading was actually looking at night shift mode with the Apple products. And they had three different groups. One group basically had no iPhone, which is very hard to do in research because everyone loves their iPhones. And then for another group, they basically had their phones, but they didn't have night shift mode on. And another group, they had their phones and they had night shift mode on. So you basically here have a comparison where you've got people that have a bright screen, but some of the blue light coming from that is either enriched or not. If you look at the comparisons in terms of how long it took people to fall asleep between those three groups, so again, no phone, bright phone, basically a nice glow, warm, fuzzy phone, the difference in the time taken to fall asleep was about a minute. And it's incredible when you really look at that particular metric with all of these studies. How much longer did it take to fall asleep having the worst possible device in your face? And so you've really got a range somewhere between minus 8 to almost 10 minutes. It's really this sort of movement around zero. So here we have this situation where all throughout the internet, all throughout social media, it is difficult to fall asleep. And by definition, quantitatively, difficulty falling asleep is supposed to be longer than 30 minutes. And we've got nothing like that when we actually look at the scientific data.
I love this affirmation that it's nowhere near as clear-cut or potent. And just to be very specific here, folks, we're talking about the light from those screens. We're going to get on two devices in a second. And the reason I'm making this separation, dissection, distinction, that the light does not seem to be as detrimental to the difficulty with which you will find it to fall asleep at night. And social media, including some annoying British guy called Matt Walker, have probably overhyped the impact of that in previous years. However, I think neither you nor I at this stage still are going to say that technology with screens, and here I'm not just limiting it to iPads or iPhones, I'm talking about VR goggles, I'm talking about video game play. It's not as though that these devices do not have a deleterious impact on sleep. I don't think that's what you are going to say. I don't think that's what your new and fascinating work has been saying. And that's not what we're trying to say here. It's just simply that one of the aspects that we thought was the main bad actor that was brokering the bad deal between devices and sleep was this thing called light and the light coming from those screens. That doesn't actually seem to be as true, is sort of the take-home message here now. So in that way, I think I want to now switch gears a little bit to say, if that's the case, that these devices do still have an impact, but light doesn't seem to be maybe the principal, at least, highway through which it transacts a bad influence, then what could it be? By the way, we don't have to get into the absent evidence that, you know, there's some strange electromagnetic waves coming from these devices that have a profound impact on your sleep. I don't think there's any evidence for that, last I checked. But there are other factors from these devices. So let's get into those beyond the screens themselves. You have been a true pioneer in saying maybe it's not the screens or the light, it's the content of those devices and the experience of those devices, perhaps more so than the light, that is harming our sleep. And I'd love to sort of lean into that a little bit more. Let me start with perhaps a strange question, but for me, it's one being out in the public I get very often. It's a very strong sentiment. Why do you think that people have such strong and powerful beliefs regarding the effects of technology content on sleep? I see that there's sometimes very strong political camps that have very clear debates as to, you know, what's right and wrong, particularly regarding perhaps things like video games, etc. How is the public right about digital content and sleep in particular, and how are they wrong?
What's been fascinating to me is that when I explain to people what I've just explained to you in terms of what is the quantification of the time taken to fall asleep from a bright screen, immediately what people do is that they'll then divert attention to some other aspect of technology, and more often than not, it's content. So they'll come back and say, well, I think it's what you're doing on your device. And I believe that having a number of these discussions over the years, what I've hypothesized is that people have obviously had hundreds of experiences using technology in the evening before bed, and they are very hard to shift. They have formed their own beliefs about how technology affects their sleep, which makes sense. You know, that's how we perceive our world. In some ways, people are sort of doing their own experiments. They're sort of uncontrolled experiments, but they're nonetheless collecting data and they're sort of making observations. But what I'm starting to wonder is that when we have these conversations, when science and data are confronting and challenging their view of how their world works, that they'll draw on experiences that probably counter that, because they were maybe profound experiences, they were memorable experiences. They were not necessarily drawing up all of those hundreds of nights that were fairly mundane. And yes, they had a screen in front of their face and they fell asleep quite fine. But really getting back to the whole content, that was essentially something that we thought initially was the mechanism involved linking pre-bedtime technology use with sleep. So we did a study, and I'll just try to summarize it as quickly as possible, where we gave teenagers either 1 hour of a violent video game called Call of Duty Number 4 for all of those people back in the day. And on another night, we got them to watch March of the Penguins, which was this documentary about penguins that was narrated by Morgan Freeman. It was absolutely soothing, I would have to say. And when we looked at how long it took people to fall asleep there, so it took about 3.5 minutes to fall asleep after watching March of the Penguins. It took 7.5 minutes to fall asleep after playing an hour of Call of Duty. We were really surprised by that, but we continued. We tried to do further experiments with novel violent video games, and we struggled to stuff up their sleep. People were still falling asleep quite fine. And you would imagine when it comes to content and the amount of excitation from video games, that that would have to be one of the worst things that you could do before sleep. We've always been told really destimulate before sleep, whether it's dim the lights, don't do anything activating. And nonetheless, this is what was happening. But we really got some insights, once again from Europe, where there was this Swedish group from Stockholm who were also looking at the effects of violent video games on sleep. And they similarly, when they crunched their data and they looked at the average, they saw something similar, that it wasn't really having much of an impact. But then when they actually looked at the individuals, that's when they noticed that, hang on, some of these individuals are reacting to this content, but some of them aren't. And they're sort of canceling each other out a little bit here. And that then led us on a really interesting journey to sort of really explore what we call individual differences, the fact that some people can actually have a sensitivity to some of the content that they're looking at, and other people are much more resilient.
In some ways, what that taught us when I was reading that work is regarding the notion of personality type, that the devil is always in the details with some papers. And there's a great scientific researcher tight in the field, a guy called David Dinges. And I always remember as a younger scientist, and he would tell me always show me your variance, show me the distribution of the effect, show me who gets hit by the effect and who doesn't, and then I'll make up my mind. Don't give me averages. That's exactly what you are looking at here, that there was a unique snowflake-like effect. It affects some people. It doesn't affect other people. And I think what's wonderful is that it led you to a shift in your research focus, and you have this, you have some great turns of phrase, and a shift from perhaps the notion of before bed to what you've then described as beyond bedtime. So the before bedtime versus the beyond bedtime. Tell me a little bit about that notion and how the listeners should think about that.
In terms of mechanisms linking technology use to sleep, there was this one hypothesis that was really led by Jan Vandenbalt. And he phrased it as what's called bedtime displacement. And so the concept is that people don't necessarily use technology in the hour before bed. In fact, what they'll do is that they'll use technology before bed, but then they really get wrapped up for some reason or another in using their technology. They lose track of time, and then they push bedtime later and later. I must admit, I did this even the other day. I was watching a particular thing on Netflix, and I was like, no, I really want to continue watching this. And I pushed past my bedtime, and I paid for it the next morning. And so people will do this. And I think that this is something that we probably have to impart to the listener, is that when we're doing scientific experiments, and we've already mentioned about the content, the video game studies, we've talked about the iPad studies, we're trying to see, is something alerting? If you provide this stimulation just before your usual bedtime, do we see that this affects your sleep, that they are really alerting and you take a long time to fall asleep? But now what we're interested in is, do people push beyond their bedtime by using technology? And if they do, why is that the case? What is so special about them that pushes them well past their bedtime compared to other people? And so that's really the sort of areas that we started to explore with our research.
And so from that work, I think what it's really helped me do a better job communicating is that these devices, in some ways, they're attention capture devices, that they're designed to see if they can buy up as much of your attention economy as possible. And those devices, usually because they've got millions, if not sometimes billions of technology dollars poured into them, are very good at doing that. And they almost play on different aspects of our mentality. And again, I'm coming back to this notion of personality. Tell me a little bit about how the notion of a risk-taking personality relates to the time that these young teens were turning off their video games, and how did it factor into the sleep equation, just to get kind of nitty-gritty on this notion of everyone's different, it's about personality. What about personality are we talking about here?
Exactly. So when you think about adolescence, one of those words that will come to mind is risk and risk-taking. And risk-taking has two main components. One is that they are seeking and chasing rewards. And if you think about video games, that's really what they're based around. It's this reinforcement. Keep playing, do well, and you'll get this reward. But the other component of risk-taking are the consequences of taking risks, that there can be some sort of punishment. And so what we did in one particular study is to say, okay, let's measure the risk-taking. These two components in teenagers, we'll give them a novel video game. This time, we're not going to say, you can play this right up until your bedtime. This time we said, okay, go for it. Play it, but understand that tomorrow morning, we're going to wake you up at 7 o'clock and take you to school. This is where the risk is. Now, to our surprise, the reward sensation-seeking component did not relate into this equation when it came to technology use and sleep. It was actually the consequences of taking risks, such that for teenagers that really didn't care so much about the consequences of taking risks, they turned off the video game later than their peers who did care about the consequences of taking risks. So this was really the first evidence for us that it wasn't necessarily a one-size-fits-all when it comes to technology use and sleep. There were some people that, depending upon the type of technology that they were using, as well as an aspect of their personality, that would mean that's where you see this really negative experience when it comes to their sleep, but other people are actually resilient when they're using the exact same technology.
And that's exactly what we're talking about here, essentially, is an equation of resilience versus vulnerability and how susceptible are you to this effect. Something that I want to reconcile as I'm listening to this, I worry that people may at this stage be confused after hearing our first episode where we were speaking very much about the impact of light and light therapy, that in those early studies that you're a participant in with these LED goggles directly straight into the eyes, saturation of blue light can delay bedtime by 30 minutes, and then reverse engineering that where you can take older adults maybe who are suffering from early morning awakenings and can't stay awake in the evening to fit with society. You can use that light intervention again, and here we delay their bedtime. But now in this second episode, we're saying, well, light from devices doesn't really delay their bedtime. I think an important distinction, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Michael, is that it tells us that the intensity of light that is coming from these devices is perhaps not of the experimental, clinical, methodological intensity and specifically blue light enriched approach that you were describing in the first episode. And therefore, it's not a contradiction. It's just simply the fact, coming back to things like intensity and hue, when those are dialed down with these types of technology devices, or you're watching a screen and playing a video game, we're just not getting above that threshold of magnitude of intensity. And therefore, the hype around this idea of devices are going to make you be twiddling your thumbs for 2 hours before you fall asleep at night, is that a fair reconciliation of what may at first seem like a contradiction of the things that we've spoken about?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm glad you brought that up, because when I speak about these things, people then suddenly are almost like silent because they're confused. They're trying to reprocess all this information. And I think possibly the best way to explain this is imagine a typical night. And what I guess we're saying is that, yes, in some ways, a bright screen isn't going to make it difficult to fall asleep as long as you go to bed at the bedtime that you should. As soon as you don't regulate your bedtime, you are still going to have those alerting effects that Christian Kayokin saw and we saw as well. When you're using a bright screen, you will still feel alert. Objectively, you will be alert. And if you don't set that bedtime, you will have this whole concept of bedtime displacement. You will continue potentially to use your devices beyond your bedtime, especially if you're using a particular activity on your device that you are vulnerable to. So it is much more of a complex interaction. But the safest things you can do, and we've sort of hinted at this in a previous episode with light, is that, sure enough, just dim the screen, dim your lights in your house. You can still enjoy technology, but you need to self-regulate. You need to be able to set your own bedtimes. I mean, we do this for babies. We do this for teenagers, and we see benefits. We see that they get extra sleep. Yet it's so surprising if you ask a group of adults at a presentation how many people here have a bedtime, and so many adults laugh. They don't put up their hands. Some of them go to, and they're like, oh, God, I don't want to be the weird one. And it's really a simple technique, but it's has somehow become lost in some ways when it comes to the introduction of our devices into our rooms. So there is probably what we call an approach called harm minimization, where we say, yes, you can use technology, but just be aware of these different facets of the light that you can manipulate. Make sure that you have your bedtime, and sometimes you'll need to actually like set an alarm so that time doesn't get away from you. Maybe experiment with the type of technology that you're using. What we found fascinating is that with a lot of our studies and the great work of other researchers around the world, is that when it comes to actually watching TV, we see a near zero relationship between sleep and watching TV. And in fact, in that first study where I mentioned where we compared playing Call of Duty for an hour before bed versus watching March of the Penguins, we actually had a third of teenagers fall asleep during March of the Penguins. We had to go in and wake them up. So we're actually sort of seeing some evidence that TV actually might be sort of like the new sleeping pill for people. Potentially, people could still enjoy technology in the evening, but maybe try to de-stimulate by doing things like listening to a podcast, you know, watching TV, listening to music, reading a book. Those sort of things are less stimulating. But above all else, make sure you set your own bedtime.
This is great. So I think the summary here, and help me better understand this, but we're not saying that technology doesn't have an impact on your sleep, and aspects of it can have a detrimental, when we're talking about direction, a detrimental impact. But curb that mentality and that belief system that the light from screens is the true sort of devil incarnate that is causing and wreaking havoc to your sleep. That doesn't necessarily seem to be the case when you come back down to not experimental scientific wall of Marshall amplifier sized light boxes. When you come back down to the level of iPads, iPhones, etc., maybe television screens, it doesn't seem to be as impactful as the hype would make, is point number one. Point number two, even things that are associated perhaps with violent video games, which get this horrific rap in the media, we're not necessarily condoning violence. This topic is not about that. We're talking about the impact on sleep. That doesn't seem to have such a grotesque, detrimental impact that perhaps has been made out in the media. There are aspects that one wants to consider, however, which is your personality type. To that point, is it fair to say one of two things? How do you use technology, and what is your relationship to using it in the evening, and how best to optimize your sleep? And then the second is, if you're on just a radio or television program, which you do very frequently, and you know that they say, okay, we're coming back, and you've got 30 seconds round out before the news, what is the evidence? What is the affirmative notion that people should take away regarding technology? So maybe how have you changed, and what is your routine? And then maybe what is the take home? What is the concrete message that it does do and it doesn't do?
I think those are lovely highlights. Definitely for myself, I will wind down with watching television shows. For myself, I will have a laptop that's on our bed. I do dim the screen. I will have the volume down. It's interesting that people will sometimes sort of say, oh, but what about those cliffhangers that happen at the end of an episode, and they, you know, you want to continue watching? And it's like, well, there's been a study on that as well. And they found that it actually, people fell asleep quicker after a cliffhanger, which is fascinating. It's almost like there seems to be this sort of need or quota to fill for our excitement before we go to bed. But really, I would say that watching TV is something relaxing. We've also done some research showing that people who don't use technology can often have these worries that come to them at that sort of time of the night. And in some ways, watching TV is an escape. You know, you don't have to think about what you've got to do tomorrow. You don't have to think about sort of things that happen today. But certainly, I would have to say that the alarm goes off at this point in time at 9:45 p.m. And that's our signal to start to get ready for bed. We'll get up, brush our teeth, say goodnight to our kids, come back, watch a bit more TV because, you know, we've stood up, walked around, we're a little bit more alert. And then we'll start to feel a bit more sleepy, and we're monitoring the time. We're looking at the time, and, you know, come 10:15, 10:30, it's like, okay, time to close the laptop. Good night. And we go to sleep.
So all of these, I think for the listener, are essentially establishing a relationship with your phone where, rather than the phone or your technology controlling you and your bedtime, you decide to control how and when you use your technology and still invest in your bedtime. Don't let your technology control you. You have the control of your technology. You've just heard Michael speak about the guardrails. I think there are others that we've discussed too. I think Michael Grandner had some nice tips to say, if you can, if you want to go to the extreme, you can always put your phone on black and white, and therefore it may be less engaging. It feels less rewarding to this whole idea of personality and risk-taking and reward-seeking and getting dopamine hits that cause sleep procrastination, getting to that point of beyond bedtime rather than before bedtime. I love all of this that we've hopefully given the listener an understanding that, yes, light is important. Yes, it can have in the extreme, both detrimental impacts, but also it can have therapeutic impacts experimentally within the laboratory. But when you take it down at a step of looking at devices in general and use in populations, we spoke about those studies, it doesn't seem to be quite as strong. So it's really about not necessarily getting so wound up about light and doing all of those things. It's also about just thinking, how does this thing prevent me from getting to bed when I need to, and therefore having the sleep that I need to? This podcast is supported by Athletic Greens, which is now known as AG1. AG1 is a comprehensive nutritional drink that contains countless key health components. Actually, let me stop there. I say countless, but I actually know the company. I know how the product is made. And I believe at last count, it's over 75 different vitamins, minerals, probiotics, prebiotics, and other whole food nutrient sources. I do drink AG1 every day for the record. And also for the record, I buy my own supply because of all of the obvious integrity trappings that come with the free product. I know the company well, I know how the product is made, and I genuinely trust in their manufacturing. They are registered and approved by the Therapeutic Goods Administration. They also have GMP stamps, which means Good Manufacturing Practice badges. Basically, they're rigorous. So if you'd like to pick up an offer and get some money off your first order, and also get some free travel packs, just go to the link drinkag1.com/Matt Walker. So that's drinkag1.com/Matt Walker. And you will get some money off your purchase. So again, last time, that is drinkag1.com/Matt Walker. In truth, I do also use my own link to try and get some money off. I do buy it myself, but I do use the link to get that code money off too. And you can use that link as well. Thanks very much. One last thing I wanted to ask about, and this is a complete U-turn. This is coming from absolutely out of left field, Michael, but I thought listeners may enjoy this. You have had a stellar academic career, one that many young scientists could only wish for. I wouldn't say dream of, because no pun intended, that you've got to stay away from that as a sleep researcher. And then you made the leap out into industry, and now you're with Sleep Cycles, which is a company. And as academics, people may not know this, but sometimes people see the transition from putting down the academic chalice and moving into industry as having a stigma associated with it. Is it that you couldn't cut it in academia, so you bailed out and you went into industry? Your hundreds of publications and your decades of work certainly tell everyone that you've been able to cut it. So it's not that. I think other people have this stigma associated with, well, you're selling out, you're moving over to industry. So how have you made that decision, got comfortable with that decision? Have you received any of that criticism, even inferred? Is that water off a duck's back? Someone like me, I'm desperately insecure, I'm very sensitive to criticism. It would destroy me. How have you made that decision, and how do you think about that, right or wrong? You're always updating everyone's beliefs. How should I update my belief regarding that notion?
Yeah, it's been a fascinating journey. And in fact, when I was at the university, I remember going to a talk that was completely out of psychology, but it was really looking at the factors that determine that someone will make essentially a sea change, you know, a change in jobs. And it boiled down to two things. One was push factors, what's pushing you out of your current zone and what's pulling you away to a different place. And I certainly think that framework of thinking, it can be applied to changing jobs or changing locations, changing relationships, really. And for me at the university became a place that I didn't recognize anymore. And I think people have this notion that universities are consistent, high performer, 97, 99%. But I think there's been a real change in universities globally, where they're not necessarily focused on education, but they're focused on really making money, like another sort of company in some way. So originally, I think when we're in academia, we sort of think that if you were to be a researcher and go out to industry, yeah, that you're a sellout, that you've lost some credibility. But I think the transition isn't so much now that I've sort of had a foot in both sides. I think the thing that often holds a lot of academics back and researchers back from leaving academia is the love of just teaching the students. I think it's a big part of why we do it. We absolutely love playing a role, filling these cups, you know, these seeing these sponges absorb and then go on and do wonderful, great things because, you know, they're the next generation. And I think my experience, that was the hardest part in leaving. But at the same time, I've seen that they're not vulnerable. They're strong individuals and their well-being is absolutely sort of fine. And if anything, maybe me leaving the university and going to a company demonstrates to them that there's another option available at the end of their studies, that they don't have to try to continue and compete for academic positions when there's just so many graduates competing for these. And I would have to say now that I am on the other side of the fence, I still get to do research. In fact, if anything, the paradox is that I have been publishing more studies. I've had more time to do research. I've had more time to read research, and that has been priceless. The fact that I've increased my research knowledge, not just the depth, but the breadth of it as well. I've started to read into areas, like say, for example, if I can entertain one of those, we've spoken about melatonin and how they can be suppressed by light. Well, I've learned that outside of melatonin's role when it comes to sleep and circadian rhythms, that it's, for a lack of a better word, an incredible anti-cancer agent. And light is also involved in cancer. So it's been fascinating to see the therapeutic benefits of melatonin and to sort of step outside the sleep silo of research and see what else is out there. But in terms of working at a company now, and maybe it's particular to Sleep Cycle, and maybe it's particular to the Swedish culture, but it's been absolutely wonderful. They've been highly supportive. I think as a researcher, when you enter a company, that you should not presume that people in the company know what you do. And likewise, you don't know about their knowledge and their skills. So the first thing that you should do is really have those conversations, even have a presentation describing the sort of work you do so that people can understand how they can use you and how you can reach out to other people as well. And probably as a scientist, what people will encounter is that a company, and a company I would say is no different to a university because they both have marketing departments, but sometimes that's where you will sort of see where is your line where you are being challenged and maybe you will feel that you're being pushed to say something that's beyond your confidence and beyond what you believe to be true or not, what the science is actually saying. And I think I've been very lucky at Sleep Cycle that they have respected, they have learned, they have understood where my line is. I am very categorical to sort of say, no, there's not enough research to back up that statement. Or, yes, we can say this. I know it sounds contrary to what everything is on the internet, but there's evidence to support it. Because at the end of the day, we really do need to say things that are backed by evidence, even marketing departments as well, because, you know, there have been many instances where, say, for example, in the US, the Federal Trade Commission has fined companies for making claims that are not substantiated, and this is where science comes in. So I would hope that we see a day where a lot of companies recognize that they need scientists, and certainly we've been really blessed in sleep that there are a lot of companies that are investigating sleep. They're creating products, whether they be hardware or software or some sort of service. So I would hope and that they're listening and that they can start to entertain the idea that they can distinguish themselves from other companies and really start to think about consulting with sleep scientists.
Firstly, thank you for sharing your journey. maybe four things. The first, I would say that one of the stigmas associated with it, and I think I probably had this when I was early on and I had not started working with industry, and I do a lot of work. I'm a co-founder of a startup brain simulation company. I'm a scientific advisor to a number of other companies in the sleep space. At first, I just thought, well, it's so easy for me to see what these companies are doing wrong. I don't like some of their morals. I don't like some of their messaging. They don't really seem to understand sleep science. It was just very easy to be an armchair critic on the outside looking in to industry. And then at some point, I realized I am such a hypocrite, because one thing you can do, rather than just keep standing there and lambasting people, why don't you get out, get into the companies and decide to do something about it? Stop complaining and stop accusing them. Why don't you go and work with them and do something about it to try and help them, which was point number one. I realized how idiotic I'd been. Point number two, it's very easy to have this second stigma, which is, well, when you go out into industry, maybe academia is just full of the most remarkably intelligent and wildly windswept intellectual people. And when you go outside of that, they won't be quite that way. My goodness, was I wrong. People in industry are as, if not smarter, than many people that I interact with in academia. So that was immensely fulfilling. I think the third component to come on to is that notion of integrity that you mentioned too, that if you are going to go out into industry and play in that space, keep the integrity that Michael just described in mind. And I wrestle with that, or have to sort of maybe even fight back with some of the companies that I'm involved in, but they're always actually very good. I have never been on record, despite having these associations with these companies, as directly promoting any of them. Now, for those companies, I will certainly add my voice to the marketing and messaging regarding the importance of sleep in general, because that's part of my mission in life, is to try and get this message of sleep out there into the public. And that serves that purpose. But I have never wished to become the George Foreman grill of sleep. Nothing against George. I absolutely am a boxing fanatic and fan, and I think he's an absolute incredible human being and a boxer. But I never wanted to become that sort of salesman for sleep. Because as soon as you go out there, the public can smell that lack of genuine, authentic nature a mile away and just think, you're just a scientist who's trying to hawk a product. But if you stay above all of that and you speak about the science and maintaining the integrity of that scientific voice within these companies, you're doing good for the companies. They don't fall prey to being one of those companies that the rest of academia thinks, gosh, that's terrible marketing. That's not really the appropriate way of doing it. You help them stay away from that, which only builds brand integrity. And therefore, for someone like you or me going out there and hawking the product and, you know, singing its praises, it's a short-term win for a long-term loss. I just love all of those things that you're saying. And I've had my biases and stigmas really change by working out in industry. And like you, it's reciprocally produced a huge change in how I do my research. So many research questions. I mean, we just published a paper looking at caffeine, alcohol, and sleep in traders on Wall Street. And I would never think about doing real world science before. I was always experimental in the lab, doing everything precise, brain scanners, EEGs. I realized that the applicability of my work was really not very high. I do all of the science. It maybe get published every now and again in a fancy journal, and that's great. But did it really change the world? Not very much. Being out in industry, it taught me what was really relevant, what was really meaningful. Now, there's a great reason to do basic blue sky research. There's also a reason to do applicable research. And that's what I think I love to see. And I think that's exactly what you're doing. How can I translate everything I know to actually changing real people in this thing called the real world for real benefits? I just think you're an absolute gem for doing that. And thank you.
Oh, and the feeling is mutual. I would have to say that when you look within academia, there's been this shift from research productivity, you know, try to make an impact, do these research studies. And those research studies end up in scientific journals with jargon. And how are they really consumed by the public that could really benefit from them? And I think that's where the universities realized that we need to shift to this concept called research translation. How do we get this scientific evidence and say it in a way that people in the public can consume it and use it to better their lives? And you and I know that if you look at all these different aspects of health, all these different types of behaviors you can perform, sleep is a fascinating one because you pull that lever called sleep and it has this ripple effect and a powerful effect on so many aspects of physical and mental health. And people can relate to it because they do it. And I would have to say that now that we've got the advent of social media, and probably I've seen in the last, well, certainly since COVID, we've gone quite digital. There's been a propagation of all of this information about sleep. And I think people don't read scientific articles, and I understand why, but they'll basically report on what they've heard from other people. And that's where you get that viral misinformation. And so hence, we need people to be able to really translate that scientific research accurately. And I would have to say, you are the standout person. Your book has managed, I've actually heard people say, I read Matthew Walker's book and my sleep got better. I did these changes. And I think that's what I found fascinating when I was doing my clinical research and working clinically with people. You have someone in front of you, and it's very rewarding to be able to educate them. They make changes. They improve their quality of life because they've improved their sleep. And I wasn't satisfied with that after a while. I wanted to translate what I had learned from my clinical research and teach that to the world. And of course, digitally was the way to go, but I could not do it at my university. They were absolutely impaired. There was too many barriers. And then now this opportunity at Sleep Cycle, when they tell me we've got 60 million downloads, we've got 2 million people that use it every single night, the ability for me to just put in the same amount of effort and it be spread to millions of people, exactly like what you do. Although I would say it's not exactly like what you do because you are getting to much more millions of people. It's fantastic. And I think maybe a key message here is for a lot of researchers, whether you're in sleep or not, start trying to translate, start to practice that skill of really interpreting the science and telling the public about it, because we need you. We need you to translate accurate science. And that way people will listen and do things that work as opposed to that don't work.
An industry is one way that you can do that. But what Michael just said is another great way, which is learn how you can be a public advocate for sleep. And you saying that, it's interesting, in the past maybe 6 months, I've realized that I think one of the next courses that I would like to teach is on how to communicate science and specifically here, sleep science, to the public. And the reason I say that is twofold. First, as scientists, what the public should know is that we are never trained in the art of communication. We're never trained to be media savvy. No one teaches us how to do that. Now, it turns out that if you are a personality and a famous individual, there are something called media coaches, and they go out there and they will teach you how to be wonderfully facile, deeply erudite, and come out with just declarative prose that wows an audience and wins them over. We have no such training as scientists, zero. And I would say overall, we don't do a very good job. If you listen to a scientist interviewed on a program, you just think, oh, it's a... And Steven Pinker, a wonderful Harvard scientist, has once described that we are so vulnerable to using all of these acronyms all the time because we make assumptions. And one of the worst things that we do is we assume, in fact, what we can't do is disabuse ourselves of our own knowledge and return back to the naive state of the public listener and therefore communicate in a way that is not essentially word salad. And we're not trained to do that. The first thing I've wanted to do is try to develop a course on how to do that and make it practical, where we actually work every week on, let's say, a certain paper. Let's pick one of your fantastic papers, and we could think, how can we best communicate this? Let's create a Twitter thread. How do we want to use AI? Let's embrace it rather than try to vomit it away. How do we think about reaching out with videos and TikTok and sound bites and all of these things? I want to think about teaching the next generation to do that. Also, what I want to do is pass on the lessons, because when I came out after the book, I had no training. I'd never been really in the public eye. I was horrific as a scientific communicator. I made some spectacular faux pas. I didn't even realize that you should employ people to be proofreaders or even sort of fact check books, which may have over 1,500 facts. You're going to get some wrong, it turns out. And I got some wrong. I did so many things wrong, so wet behind the ears, that I would love to prevent other people from doing that in the future. And so I love this call to arms that you offered there. I think it's so essential that we disabuse our young scientists, that it is selling out once again if you go out into the public and you become some kind of a voice in the public. It's not selling out necessarily, as long as you do it accurately and with integrity. Those are the things that I will teach you based on my painful lessons as to the lack thereof. Not only should you not be afraid of it, I would say it is your academic intellectual responsibility to do it, because the taxpayer money that you receive for your grants comes from those very same people. Gosh, what a soapbox rant that I should probably end. Michael, is there anything else that you would love to leave the audience? Tell people where, again, they can find you, talking about social media, on the internet, on the web. Where can we find you, wonderful person?
Thank you very much. And it's been a pleasure to discuss these things. And you've been a wonderful person to discuss them with. So in terms of where to find me, I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. I actually find the conversations there are a little bit more intellectual. But also check out Sleep Cycle, the app. That's where a lot of the sort of scientific research and content that I work on 5 days a week is being expressed. You know, say, for example, we've got ways to help you sleep there and measure your sleep. And furthermore, I've got my own small company called Wink. So you can Google search Wink Sleep. And essentially that one there is really that I've enjoyed teaching so much and I love seeing people sort of evolve. So really, Wink is there to help people do what I do, to sort of learn those therapeutic tools to be able to help other people sleep better. And all of that is based upon science. And it's absolutely just directly from myself as a scientist and a clinician and just translating that information to people to be able to sort of, like I said, do what I do.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Michael Gradizar, find him on LinkedIn. Go visit Wink. Go explore sleep cycles. Michael, for who you are and what you do, thank you, my good friend.
And thank you, my dear friend, as well.
Okay, folks, that is it for this episode. Thank you for listening. We wish you good pseudo-illuminated sleep this evening. Take care. Bye for now.